Well, welcome to the latest episode of Rich Tapestries with Bryce Davies, and my co-host is Nuria Gonsalves. Welcome, Nuria. Good to see you again.
Hello, Bryce. Good to see you too. Thank you so much.
And our guest on the podcast today is none other than Mr. Sam Foe. Is that how you say it? Is it Foe?
Yeah, Foe, yep.
Well, that's good because I've been calling you Sam Foe for the last 30 years, and it would be good to make sure that we haven't been getting that wrong for so long. We've known each other for a while, haven't we, Sam? I think we met each other back in Melbourne sometime. But recently we've been doing some emergency relief flood work up in Townsville. Were you up in Townsville with us? Or
yeah,
I think
that's
we were.
Yeah, Townsville.
No, we've been able to.
We're in Ingham.
In Ingham, that's right. So always good to be with you and good sense of humour. We've always had a good bantering type relationship, Sam. I really enjoyed that. So looking forward to hearing your full story. So over to you, Nuria. What have you got to tell us about Sam that we don't know?
Thanks, Bryce. And yeah, as Bryce mentioned, our guest on the podcast today is someone with a big heart, a deep faith, and as you rightly mentioned, Bryce, a great sense of humor. Lieutenant Colonel Samuel Foe. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is correct, Nuria. Yeah.
Awesome. And I believe your name, which was given to you by your parents, was Suyan. Is that have you pronounced?
That's correct, beautiful. Yes.
Is it that? Two and four. And Sam, you are a proud husband to Donnie and a father to four wonderful daughters, which I got from our conversation. So Sam is a lover of basketball, a student of sports, and never says no to a fat, juicy steak. Wow. I mean, I couldn't believe. I thought, you know, when I was talking to Sam, he would say something like noodles or fried rice, but yeah, I discovered that it was a fat, juicy steak. And just so we start off on the right foot, I would like to say ne o to everyone, which is hello in Cantonese. And Sam's journey with the Salvation Army began long before he ever wore the uniform, and which is in 1978. We'll hear a lot more from Sam when he arrived in Melbourne to a refugee home from Vietnam and then under Australia's humanitarian program. So a new country, no English, and a whole lot of unknowns. But his first mission was to find a church, somewhere to worship, somewhere to belong, and to be in the community. And I would say, thank God, literally, for the Salvation Army, which became that place of faith, family, and purpose. So over the decades, Sam, you have Sam's ministry has taken him far and wide, from the heart of Melbourne's Chinese schools to leading the Hong Kong and Macau command, and then on to Canberra as a national secretary, and eventually back to Melbourne in the communications department. So he has served faithfully, preached passionately, and shared more than a few good laughs along the way. And today we are honored to sit down with this joyful, wise, and wonderfully humble leader to hear about his remarkable journey of faith, resilience, and service. Welcome to the podcast, Lieutenant Colonel Sam Foe.
Thank you, Nuria.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. What's what to say? Doje.
Oh, okay. There you go. Doje. Awesome.
So tell me, Sam, about your very early life and where you were born and your mum and dad and what they did for a living.
Well, I was born in a hospital, of course. No, not really. No, I was born in a family I'm number three in the family, so I've got two older brothers and me, and then later I've got my younger brother and younger sister.
Okay.
So my dad, my mum and dad started as primary school teachers, and later on my dad went into the banking business, started in the bank and things like that. By the way, they all passed on now. Then having said that, we live in a very small apartment, only one room, you know, with six of us there.
And where was this?
That's in Saigon, formerly Saigon, now is Ho Chi Minh City. And my, because we got at the time we had four, they had four boys, so it's too much for them. We only have a you know, the Italian Vespa, the little,
yeah,
that had a Vespa, so we cannot put everyone on in it, you know. So what happened is that my mom's friend told her, said, look, you know, not far from where we were, our house, there's a church there. Why don't you bring the kids to the church? You know, they might spend a Sunday morning there, and then you two can go out and do something for yourself. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. So that's how I started to go to church. And really, I think the original purpose was to babysit us. I loved it there. And in fact, you know, by the time we became teenagers, only me stay in the church. You know, in the church children's choir or young people's choir, I was the only boy in the whole group. How's that? Wonderful.
Wow. Right? One way to meet your girlfriends, mate. That's a good strategy. A lot of people joined the church to find their true love. But it's interesting that the church there was... Christian church in some way. Was that? Tell me a bit more about
church,
that.
The church original sort of denomination was the Christian Missionary Alliance Church.
Okay.
Yeah. I think all the Chinese churches in Vietnam started by that missionary group. So we were one of the branches in Saigon. There were about probably four or five branches there, churches there. So we were one of them in Saigon. In fact, we were the only one in Saigon.
So I'm a bit confused because it sounds like the church that you went to was Chinese, but you're in Vietnam. Is that right?
Oh, that's right. Well, we by the way, let me tell you this. The Chinese people in Vietnam actually are massive, you know, especially where in Saigon, there's a big population.
Huge population. Okay.
Yeah, huge population. And in fact, when I was growing up, you know, I went to Chinese school. You know, I was brought up a Chinese education as well as Vietnamese education. That's because of the national language, thing like that. And so therefore, you know, I had concurrently two educational system. One from Taiwan, because we belong to our education program actually from Taiwan, and then the local educational program. So we studied two at the same time.
So is your family of origin, like your grandfather and so on, are they from China, or are you always, like, your distant relatives are Chinese, is that right?
That's correct. My paternal grandfather, actually from in China, and my mother was born in China, but my father was born in Vietnam.
Okay.
So why did they move? Speak Vietnam, Chinese, sorry.
Yeah. So why did you move from China to Saigon?
Well, funny you said that, because I didn't have a lot of information about my family history. I was told that my grandfather's family was a very rich family. And during the communist sort of regime, sort of, you know, uprising, whatever you call it, then the family was persecuted. So they, when I say persecuted, mean can be killed, you know, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Because of the wealth that they accumulated. Yeah. So they ran away, and so they went to Vietnam. That's all I knew, really.
That's all you know. Yeah. Mm.
And my grandfather actually married someone in Vietnam. So my paternal grandmother wasn't a Chinese, it was a Vietnamese. So I've got mixed blood.
Yeah. And what was school like for you? Did you like school? Did you flourish at school? Or were you a good boy or a naughty boy or good at sport?
I don't think the word naughty actually describes
it. It's probably not a good question, is it? Did you thrive at school, or was it difficult for you?
Well, to be honest, you know, now that I look back, you know, I think I could do much better, but I never actually strive to get the best, to be honest.
Yeah,
So I'm above average. Never, I think, from memory, of all my high primary school, I only 1 year, I actually attained number 3 award, you know, so bronze award, you know, in the class. Mm. That's the only year that I got that. So that means I could do it, but I never actually did strive for the best. You know, that's a weakness for me.
Okay. Yeah. And so as a teenager, did you still attend church and you sort of stayed on the straight and narrow path, or were you a bit rebellious? What were you like as a teenager?
Oh, I love the church. In fact, as I said to you before, you know, of all my siblings, I was the only one actually left the church for the whole time, never left the church. Although having said that, though, I must say that I also had during teenage years, you know, I also had my doubts and had my questions and rebellious sort of attitude, that sort of thing, you know. So I did have that. I went through all that. But at the end, you know, I think I came back to the church. I came back to the community, really. And I think because I was the only boy for at least 1 or 2 years, I got spoiled. Then what do you leave when you get spoiled? You know, that sort of thing, you know. Think about that. That's in hindsight, of course.
Of course, yeah. And so how old were you when you came to Australia?
I was 21. Saigon fell in 1975, April the 30th, when I was 17. So I stayed until 1978, October. June 21st. Actually, I left Vietnam on my 21st birthday, on the day.
Right.
That was a big, big presence for me, my mum and dad.
Yeah, yeah. And so Saigon fell. Tell me a bit more about that situation. Is that part of the Vietnam War?
As you know, the Vietnam War has been going on for a long, long time, you know, since the American involved, and the war became bigger and bigger. I was growing up in a war, you know, I knew nothing else. And I still remember people asked me, well, you never went camping? And I said, no. I said, why not? I said, mines. You know, that kind of stuff. In fact, when you talk about education thing, it's a funny thing. We have, of course, summer break for a few months. And summer break for us is half-day study. Normal study, full day. Summer month, half-day. So, but, however, we can choose whatever we want to study, you know, but still half day, so that, you know, because we have nowhere else to go, what can you do? And you're sitting at home, we have no TV, not much we can do.
So do you remember being afraid, and was there bombing in your suburb, and, you know, guns?
I must say, you know, firstly, I was young. Secondly, it's part of life already, you know, I mean, the adults got worried so much. I remember we had one family came from probably about a few kilometers from where we were, and they came to stay with us. Only a few kilometers away. So they came to stay with us. And the whole family of four, the father never slept at night. I don't know how he could do it. He just had a cigarette and puffing a cigarette every night, and then a cup of tea through all night. And then he dressed everything ready to go. It's any time. So that's how worried he was. For us kids, the one thing that was good, no school. We can play, muck around, that sort of thing. I didn't feel any scary thing at all. I still remember my dad told me, at night, you know, the enemy sort of bombing Saigon. The way you get hit, just like you won a jackpot. Not easy to get hit.
It's like getting struck by lightning. Yeah,
that's right. However, the thought you may get hit really worries the adult. And then I was told that, you know, look, if you hear the bomb, you're okay because passing over your head. If you don't hear it, then you're in trouble.
Hear it, you're probably already dead, aren't you? Right?
Something like that. So that's talking about. I don't think I was sort of frightened, anything like that. You know, when I see a tank in the street or machine guns or whatever, it's everywhere. So for us, we used to it, really. You know.
Yeah.
Then again, I must say we were young too, so we didn't care really.
So as asked earlier, Sam. So you said that you came to Australia when you were 21 on your birthday. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that happened and why? You ended up in Australia.
Yeah. Well, before I left, of course, the situation, the war situation in Saigon wasn't going very well at all for outside of the government. So therefore, we knew. And then again, you know, President Ford said the Vietnam history. So that means that's it. You know, American got to pull out. And when they pull out, that's it. South Vietnam's going to go forever. And therefore, you know, people are trying to get out. Now, even before that, say, for example, my two brothers, older brothers, they left in 1972, so 3 years before the fall of Saigon. Why? Because they were at the age of conscription. That means they could be, you know, pulled out of a school or university and go to war straight away. So therefore, my mom and dad had to send them out that year. And then I didn't go out. And then 1975, Saigon fell. Now, let me tell you one thing that I learned that I felt so strongly was the fact that when communist soldiers marched into Saigon, when the tank broke, the big iron gate in the Independence Palace where the former president worked, and when I saw that, you know, for the first time in my young life, the word hopelessness became very real. And that was so heavy for me mentally and spiritually, so heavy, you know, for a young 17 years old, you know, suddenly you sense hopelessness. And you can see that. So therefore, my mom and dad said, look, you had to go. And then arranging for me to leave, of course, always illegally, because there was no proper sort of migration program for you to go. So for us to leave, I mean, you have to escape. We use the word escape. Yeah. You either walk somewhere toward the north or toward the east. There is no good. There is, you've got to walk through Cambodia, which is, you know, the Khmer Rouge, even worse than the Vietnamese communism. For my dad, the best way is to take the boat and they're going south from Saigon, going south. So that was a way to go. And some people go south and then turn east and go to Thailand. And I go south all the way down south. And then we reach Malaysia. Now, the way to manage an escape was very delicate because got to be secret. As you know, the government don't want anyone to go away, you know. So you see, my boat had no compass, going in the big sea, big ocean. And you could understand the reason for this. At the time, if you go and buy a compass, what do you need a compass for? You know what I mean? The government straight away, or someone drop you in, and you're in trouble. So they took the risk, go without compass. And then I asked the fellow who drive the boat, I said, how? No, you know where to go? Oh, see the stars. Yes, you know, by the star, you can know which way. And which way is it there? And that's it. And then I asked him, do you know where we're going? He said, no. I mean, we only know going south. That was it.
Wow. And
was the boat you had a sailing boat or a petrol boat? Did you need fuel and so on?
Yes, our boat is about 20 meters long and 4 meters wide. 182 people there, all right? Young and old. And let me tell you, the engine sound like this. It's not like that.
More like a lawnmower, yeah.
It's something like two machines, you know. And we just left. Now, we pay in gold. My dad paid more than 15 ounces of gold for me to get on boat. No guarantee whatsoever. I mean, you apart from water, that was rationed every day. Other than that, nobody gave you any food, anything like that. You were left on your own.
And how long were you on the boat?
5 days.
Wow.
We should travel full steam down south.
Did that go to Malaysia or?
Well, we finally reached Malaysia, but we didn't know that was Malaysia, do you believe? Because we had no idea, just there, and that's it, you know? So that sort of journey. I mean, I tell you, I wouldn't have done that again. I wouldn't do it again. I wouldn't do it again. It's quite frightening. And I still, you know, every time I hear the water going on the side of the boat, you know, you know, create a lot of angst in me.
Anxiety. Brings back those scary memories.
Can I give you some very, very sort of vivid and very primitive thing now? And may not be suitable for podcast, but I will tell you because that's life, right? Now, 182 people on board.
Mm.
How do you solve the problem of toilet?
Mm.
Think about it.
I don't really want to think about it, Sam. If that's
I know.
Okay with you.
No, I'm seriously. I mean,
yeah. Don't you just go over the side?
Yeah.
Well, yes, that's all. For men, you did that. Okay. Now you've got to remember, you've got to hold on to something. If you drop in the ocean, see you later, mate.
Yeah, they're not coming back for you. Yeah.
And by the way, another thing too, it's not funny, but it's real. You've got to know where the wind blowing.
Yeah. Yes, you do.
And there was no shame.
Yeah.
We are absolutely animals.
Mm-hmm.
We are actually animals. Let me tell you one incident happened to me, right? Let me tell you. This always reminds me of the fact that we are sinners, right? Now, let me give you this. Somehow I found a hole somewhere in the boat. They've got a hay underneath it, and then nobody actually was there. So I just went down there. Hallelujah, I can lie down because nobody was there. Lying on the hay. And I was told that was a wooden toilet, by the way, later on. I didn't know that. And I was so seasick. And as soon as the boat left, I became seasick. Anyway, one day I was woken up by some sort of quarrel on the deck. And I listened to it. And then I realized it was a fight between a husband and wife over food. And then I said to myself, come on, you know, husband and wife, you know, you escape together, you know, you look after each other. And now you're fighting over food. Why don't you share the food? You know, goodness sake. Now, that's a judgment I made. I must admit, that's a judgment I made. That's very quickly I made this. And you know what? Suddenly, a piece of fruit fell down from there. I don't know whose fruit belonged to, but anyway, it fell down. It's that big. That big, and it's, I don't know whether you know the fruit called yam, Y-A-M, bean.
Yes.
You know, it like the outside like a leather. You know, the flesh is very juicy, very crispy, and white. That one. For 5 days, that's all I had for the tree. Mm. Okay. Now, the thing I want to tell you was that when the food came down, I quickly grabbed it. You know what I said? If anyone come down to get back one, I'm going to kill that person.
Mm.
Now, I really meant it.
Mm.
You know, it scared me. It really scared me. I said, I just couldn't understand suddenly. You know, I just criticized someone fighting over food. Here, underneath here, I'm willing to kill for food.
Mm.
I was an animal, absolute animal.
Mm.
I never forgotten that. And until today, I still remember that.
It sounds like that's something that kind of keeps you humble and stops you from judging anyone, no matter how bad their behavior.
Well, by the grace of God, let me tell you, you and I can be like that one day. You know, if you are in that sort of situation. Oh, I'm not saying about you. I'm not talking about me. I was that like that. You know, goodness me. You know, it's frightening. Very frightening to me.
Wow, that must be scary. Like, I've already got, listening to this, just got the pins and needles all over. It's very scary. It's
but nobody came there, by the way. Hallelujah.
Yes.
You know, you say grace before meal. That was the most sincere
grace. Yes, yes. Thank you for this food. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
that was the only thing I had for five days.
Yeah.
Can you believe that?
So you got to Malaysia. Through all of those trials, what happened when you got to Malaysia and how did you end up in Australia?
Okay, well, at the time, the few countries around the world decided that they will accept boat people because so massive influx of boat people, you know, around the world. So they did that, and then because of that, the Malaysian government accepted us, and then we were given the status as a refugee by United Nations Commission for Refugees.
Mm.
And because of that, as a refugee, then I had the I was entitled to apply to resettle in a third country, Malaysia being the second. So that's it. When I got to the refugee camp in Malaysia, where my one was on an island, I mean, we had to get a boat over there. So we were on this side of the island. I said, oh, we're going to go to the refugee camp. And I thought the refugee camp, I said, I'm going to have a steak, you know, when I get there. That's a piece of steak. I had no idea. I was so naive. Seriously, I was so naive. By the way, I must say, my dad never told me anything about the escape. He just said, son, you're going today. And that's it. Mm. Never gave me any information. Now, I thank him for that now, looking back. You know why? Because otherwise I wouldn't have gone.
Mm.
You know what I mean? I would have been so scared to go.
Mm.
Anyway, yes. So we're waiting for the boat to take us to refugee camp. And I got my sandals. I said, I'm going to throw the sandal away because I'm going to get a new one. How much money I've had? I had $60. That's all I had. My mom gave me $60. I said, oh, I'm going to have a piece of steak. I'm going to buy a new pair of sandals, that sort of thing. But then I said, I keep them because, you know, these are the sandals that I brought all the way from Vietnam, at least, you know, for some sort of souvenir, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Thank God I did that. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to walk on the beach because it was so hot, you know, it burned your feet.
Yeah.
When I got there, it's nothing like I imagined. It was absolutely a piece of land where people build huts using bamboo leaves and things like that, build huts, and you do it yourself. Mm. And thank God, when I got there, my friends already there, my friends from church, they left. Mm. You know, Major On, by the way, Bryce, you heard about him? He was with me in the same session. Anyway, he was there already. Mm. So as soon as I got there, I got someone to receive me, and then I got somewhere to stay. So
yeah.
That was, thank God, was hallelujah good. For that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And when we got to Malaysia, then the refugee camp, then the resettlement process start rolling. I mean, by making application, then in front of me, anywhere I want to go in the world, as long as they have the program to accept refugees, then I can apply.
Yeah.
Then originally I wanted to go to New Zealand. You know why? Because New Zealand, my former pastor already there. So I thought New Zealand's good, so I can go there. Now, Australia also was in my thinking simply because before we left a church, we got a pack of four people. We said we're going to meet each other in Australia. So that's Australia. And then maybe Canada. I said, Canada's too cold. And then America. Now, America, I never wanted to go to America, to be honest with you. But America was the last place that you can go if nobody accepts you.
Right.
See?
So where did you go in Australia? Where did you land?
I came to Melbourne. Directly.
In Melbourne.
I was supposed to, as a single person, I was supposed, I didn't have any choice. I couldn't say, I want to go to Sydney. As long as you have a family, however remote related, they will put you there. But I didn't have anyone in Australia.
Yeah.
So they can put me anywhere they like. Now, for your information, Bryce, my name was down for Brisbane. But the day of departure, I was told, sorry, you can't go. I said, why not? Said, because your lungs got problem. But my lungs didn't have any problem. It was a case that, as you know, when you have an x-ray of the lung, you had to stop breathing, you know, for a few seconds, but I didn't. So I kept breathing, and so the x-ray wasn't clear. Wasn't clear.
So
I had to go for another x-ray. So but the second trip happened to be in Melbourne, so I landed in Melbourne. There you are.
Okay.
Wow. So where in Melbourne did you actually live?
The government, the government actually set up four different hostels, one in Maribyrnong, one in Springvale, one in Nunawading, one in Williamstown. And mine, I was sent to Williamstown. I was a second arrival in Williamstown Hostel. Hence, my home call was in Altona.
Wow. Then. Okay. Yes. So how did that transition from being a monolingual Vietnamese Chinese high school student to living in a migrant hostel, I believe, right, in Melbourne, change your view of identity and belonging?
But firstly, I must say, I was living in not the monocultural lingual society. See, I spoke Vietnamese. Mm. I spoke a few different dialects of Chinese. And then yeah. I spoke French, okay? Mm. English, no, okay? So that I had experience in multilingual sort of society, no problem.
Okay.
So for me to learn the language won't be mm. very hard for me. It's mm. not a boastful thing, but really, because I've got this sort of experience, okay? The difficulty was that I feel very lonely. Well, I knew no one there. In Australia, I knew no one. You know, mm. and then when you cannot communicate with people, or you had no one to communicate with, then, you know, you absolutely felt absolutely terrible.
Yeah.
You know, and, yeah. And then don't forget, I had to start a new life from scratch.
Yeah. Mm. Mm.
So the government actually was very, very good. At least we were provided accommodation and food. The government, I didn't have to pay anything. From memory, every fortnight, I received so-called special benefits. I got about $40-something after deduction of for food and lodging and things like that. Yeah, that's all I had. It's about $40 per fortnight. Yeah, so I started from there. They organized so-called orientation program, whereby they provided a bit of an English lesson so that at least you know how to say. I want this and thank you or how much and you know, ask direction, that sort of thing. And then after that, they taught us how to use the banking system and telephone system and that sort of thing. So orientation program. After that, see, I arrived in Australia October 1978. So before 1979, I went through the orientation program as well as an English study program. Now, that study program actually was for young people preparing to go into tertiary study. At least we they equip us enough English to study. So to study. I went for that.
What did you study?
Well, I continued my phys ed, a physical education study.
Ah, so you'd done that in Saigon, had you?
Okay. I did that in Saigon, yeah.
Okay.
And by the way, I had to do that. Otherwise, I would have ended up fighting Cambodia in the war.
Yeah.
So that was a blessing, by the way.
Sure.
It's not easy.
Yeah.
So you're at university and you're studying physical education. Yeah. And how did you end up connecting with the Salvation Army?
Well, I met the Salvation Army when I was in the hostel, a very early arrival. There were two organizations came to look after the refugees, one from Red Cross. The Red Cross gave us like toothbrush and toothpaste, that sort of stuff, you know. And then the Salvation Army came in. Now, Major Brian Caulfield was the one. You know,
yes.
Major Brian Caulfield,
yes,
you know
Major
him?
Brian, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He was the refugee and migrant officer, so-called, at the time. And he came over. And then when I saw him, and I said, oh, Salvation Army. Now, I didn't know a lot of English. At least I know Salvation Army. You know, I said, oh, I heard the name before. The only thing I knew about the Salvation Army was that Salvation Army was not a Catholic. It was a Protestant.
Yeah.
Said, oh, well, that's good. Then I actually approached the major. Somehow I made it him understood I wanted to go to church. Okay. I said, okay. And in the same time, I also, through the hostel management, I told the manager, I said, okay, no, I wanted to go to church. So the hostel manager arranged for me to go to church on the Sunday. The Sunday morning, I went to church, and then Sunday evening, Major Caulfield came in and picked me up to go to church, and I was on a call. Okay. Hence, you see, and that's all. And oh, by the way, I must tell you a story. At the morning church I went to, I saw the minister puffing a cigarette, and I said, "Oh, that's not my religion." But in the evening, when I went to Altona Court, you know what the first sign I saw, apart from the crest? The first sign I saw was smoking strictly prohibited. That's it. That's my church. That's it. That's how I got to know the Salvation Army. And then later on, I reveal my desire to become a minister, a full-time minister. And Brian said to me, hey, that's good. We have Shannon College here. I had no idea what they're talking about. that's how we got from there. Yeah.
So you went for the officers training eventually. Is that right, Sam?
That's correct. In Melbourne. Yep.
Yeah. And so during your time at the officer training college, which single spiritual discipline, so maybe study, prayer, or service, or silence, challenged you most? And why did that discipline feel foundational to sensing God's call?
For me, the spiritual thing is not like that. But having known my background in the war and soldiers, thing like that, the most important thing for me is to obey, because the Salvation Army. You know what I mean? So I obey. That's all I know. And not to talk about spiritual discipline, thing like, no, that's not my thing. I said I have to do what I'm told to do. That's saying I've got to be faithful, I've got to be loyal, I've got to be committed to the Salvation Army. That's a beginning. Don't talk about spiritual thing. For me, is somewhere up there. You know, I joined Salvation Army. By the way, I thank God for that, because I needed that. Otherwise, you know, as a young person, I can do anything I like, can I?
Seriously. That's surreal. And you know, God is always at work, and He knows what is best for us.
I'm still holding this attitude. You know, I'm still obeying the Salvation Army. That sense, you know. I don't know whether it's good or not. It's up to people think about it, but that's me.
Wow.
And how did you meet your wife? What's that story?
Oh, that's a romantic story.
You've got three days. Just give us the brief details, Sam. We don't want to go too graphic here.
No. Donnie and her family were sent to Sydney. I didn't know anything about it, of course. No contact. I knew of her and of her family in Vietnam, but no contact whatsoever. And when she sent me a letter, no, actually she didn't. She actually passed on a letter from my brother's girlfriend in the same refugee camp. Then when I said to send us, I know this name, Donnie Koo. I know this family. And as you know, I would appreciate at the time there was no mobile phone, thing like that. And I had no one to know. I was lonely. Suddenly I knew someone. Oh, it's a girl. Oh, she looked right for memory. So I started writing to her. And that's it.
Yeah.
There you are. Okay. And then she came down to Melbourne. And then, you know. And then, by the way, thank God she joined the Salvation Army in Kempsey.
Oh, wow.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. So not because of me. She joined in her own right.
Separate to you. Yeah.
Separate to me. And when she came down, she said, there you are. Bang.
There you go.
So tell me a bit about your ministry, Sam, and what sort of things you've been up to since you've been a Salvation Army officer.
Well, majority of my ministry was in four. I think I still hold a record of staying in the Corps for 20 years.
Really?
That's right. This is a Chinese-speaking Corps, Chinese Corps in Box Hill. I stay until I was sent to Hong Kong. So 20 years in that Corps. So I knew the community very well, you know, the police and the hospital and school and things like that, the council, they knew me very well. So I enjoyed that. After that, I was sent to Hong Kong as the officer commanding. And after that, for 4 years, I came back to a PR. And then I was sent to Canberra as the national secretary. And then after that, I came back to Melbourne and then became the communication department, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Wow. And tell me about how integrating into Australian culture and language and even food, although you've been a steak lover since you were a child, so that's a very Aussie meal. But tell me a bit about the transition language and culture-wise, and what sort of things helped you learn?
At the time when I arrived in Melbourne, one thing I know for sure that I could never go back to Vietnam at the time, okay, because I left illegally. So therefore, Australia became my home.
Yeah.
You like it or not, this is my home. So I need to live here. And I need to live here happily. how can I live here happily? Firstly, I need to know how to speak the language. So that's the first thing is I must learn to speak English. So there's no way, no other way about it. This is what I learned. And secondly, I think, look, if I want to be part of this community, not only I need to know the community, and as well as I need to let them know me. So I need to open myself and let people know me. So, you know, I don't mind talking to you about things, you know, in Vietnam or about myself, no problem, because that's conversation, that's communication. So thirdly, I think I need to say, look, you know, I cannot live like in Vietnam. This is Australia. So somehow I need to know this is reality. So, for example, I never liked to eat cornflakes. You know, I never had it before, never in my life. And I thought, oh, should I eat in cardboard and things like that, you know? Let me tell you, I still have a little memo from Trenton College allowing me to buy instant noodles because I couldn't stand, you know, sort of so boring, you know, this sort of breakfast. Anyway, I eat it now, no problem, you know, because I know I need to change my expectation. But I still something that I, of course, if I have a choice, I prefer to eat rice, of course.
Of course.
You know, I wouldn't change that. But see, the other thing also is that there is a friction between fitting in and belonging. So to start my life, new life here, the first thing I need to fit in. Now, whether I like it or not, I need to fit in. But when I feel belonging, that's another thing. You see?
When did that happen? I mean, I'm curious about how good a job the Salvation Army did of embracing you and loving you and bringing you into the family, and whether that was your experience or whether you found a sense of belonging somewhere else or in lots of places.
Well, I would be honestly say that it depends on officers. I joined the Salvation Army because I felt belonging. Major Brian Caulfield actually took me in, no problem. But not everyone like that. That's right. So therefore, you know, you see I'm in and out of the two situations. One is fitting in, one to belonging. Sometimes I really feel that the fitting in is still a very strong demand on anyone other than white people. We need to fit in to the Salvation Army. This is what we are. Okay. Like or not, if you join us, this is what we do. And so therefore, you know, if the stronger the fitting in thing, you know, plays, then the lesser the belonging, the sense of belonging is going to be. And therefore, I think at the moment, I think the army is going this way, this way, this way, this way, you know, but the fitting in is still very strong.
If you were mentoring a young migrant officer struggling to belong, what would you suggest?
I think, as I said before, you know, my way of doing things is you must open yourself and let people know about you. You know, if you don't open up, they don't open up for you either. So the first thing is open up. And then secondly, learn how to communicate. If you cannot share with people, nobody actually want to talk to you. Now, Australians are very impatient people, you know. I went to the pub, you know, if I didn't speak, wasn't able to speak to the people in the pub, they didn't give you two hood, right? You know that price? They don't just ignore you totally. But if you can talk back to them, hey, who knows? You know, that sort of thing. So that's a basic thing. A lot of people still, when they come to Australia, they bring the whole way of life from where they were, came back here and live here. And then no wonder they cannot mix with people. For example, people say, oh, you know, I don't want to go to English-speaking church because I don't want to listen to English. I'd rather go to Chinese. I said, why not? I mean, this sort of thing is very, very narrow sort of thinking. You know, I encourage you to look, go to talk to people and then get to know them. Not everything is good, but at least you know. Know the environment, know your city, know your country, know your state and things like that. You know, you find the sense of belonging getting bigger and bigger.
That's a very wise and grounded advice, I would say. And thank you for sharing that. So how are you intentionally investing in the leaders now who you will want to carry the mission forward with cultural humility and, adaptive vision?
My way. Now, this is very subjective here. My way is, firstly, I will be with them. My presence will be with them. You know, I don't give them up. Okay. Secondly, I think for me, I need to live out my faith. If if they cannot see my faith living out for me, no way they can follow me. Not follow me, but no way they will do it. You know. So that's the only two things that I would say to people. You know, giving them advice is, to me, sometimes is not the priority. You know, I let the dog. This is how I live. You know, and if you like it, well, you have your choice.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you know, if I tell you a lot of advice, give you a lot of advice, you're going to be very unhappy about me.
I remember Sam at I think we went to Brengle together, didn't we? And played a lot of table tennis. Is that right?
That's correct. Yep. I think always a loser.
Yeah, you're always losing. Yeah. No, it's good for your humility to be defeated. But I think what you're saying is you get to know people by being with them and engaging with them. And like, I don't think I've ever had a deep theological conversation with you, but I've played a lot of table tennis and we've served people on the front line at a flood. And there's a sense of camaraderie and fellowship in that. That is, I think, your style, isn't it? That's what works for you. It's coming alongside and connecting. Right, and I think I'm a bit the same. I feel close to you because of those experiences that we had.
When I was in Hong Kong, you know, I often travel into China, of course, in a part of my turf, and that's the way to protect your safety, because it is illegal to preach to people.
You can show them, but you can't tell them.
That's right. But if they ask you, because what you did, you can tell them.
Yeah. We finish all our interviews with this question. What would you say to your 15-year-old self if you could speak into that young man's life with what you know today?
I have always told my people in the core, never give up your faith. That's the only thing that kept me alive.
You found hope because you lost hope, didn't you? I think what you're saying is somewhere mysteriously outside of logic and reason and what's ahead of you, hold on to hope. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And my faith is so important.
Yeah.
You know, and doesn't matter. Nothing else. You know, keep your faith.
Yeah, that's good, Sam.
That's beautiful, Sam. Keep your faith and hold on to it. So, Sam, I would say this conversation has been so rich. Of course, was funny at times, moving and deeply spiritual. And you have taken us from a migrant, hostel to global ministry and reminded us that God can work with whatever we surrender to Him. It can be language barriers to anything. And your story is truly a testimony of God's faithfulness, but your resilience, your humility and joy. And thank you so much for sharing it openly. So I would say, amen to everything you said. And if you have been encouraged by this episode, share it with someone who needs to be reminded that they do belong and their voice matters and that faith can thrive across every border. So until next time, this is Nuria Gonsalves and, of course, Bryce Davis signing off with gratitude and a heart full of hope. And as Sam would say, is it Zai Ji Yan? Is that goodbye in Vietnamese, Sam? How would you say that?
In Cantonese, it means Joy Gin.
Joy Gin. So
joy Gin, that's it.
Joy Bin, friends, and stay blessed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joy Gin.
Joy Gin. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.